bit. Ruth chapter 1 verse 16. And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. And whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. And thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. You and Ruth have a message to people. And you'll find the message you have for people in this little book. It's to the lost. Because Ruth started as lost. Where is God in a land that has lost God and lost its way? So life seemed to her, as it must do to you and me, full of bad contradictions. And if we're honest, even as Christians, we find those contradictions very difficult. And when I talk to people who are very, very ill, they find it extremely difficult to accept. Now, we're not looking at Romans, and we're not looking at a book of theology, but a simple story, and the story is your story, my story. Now, this woman found the answer to life in finding God, and Ruth just means a friend or friendship. So this woman is friendship. Now, if you want to know the value of this book, you look in 2 Timothy 3:16, for all scripture is given by inspiration of God, and is profitable for what? For reproof, for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. Now you'll find that this book is exactly that. It's got doctrine in it, quite a lot of doctrine. It has reproofs for those who give up on faith and get all shaken up by the things that happen to them. It has correction, where we miss our way and put our feet down wrong, and it equips us to be righteous. So then, this book starts there, but it goes on to show something very wonderful. God working out his purposes. Now, God is working out a purpose in your life and in mine, and it's very difficult to see the purpose, very difficult indeed, but there is an actual purpose in every tiniest thing that has ever happened to you since birth, and it's all part of a plan. You see, Naomi went out of God's land in a famine. People argue she shouldn't have gone and all sorts of things. Well, I don't know, perhaps she shouldn't have done. Certainly it wasn't complete faith, but I do know this, that a famine is a very difficult thing to face, and she had to face it. And in that other land, the Jews said God was displeased with her because she lost her husband and her two sons and was left a widow. Well, you can't prove that God is displeased with anyone because they lose their husband and son and are left a widow. That doesn't follow on. That's a Jewish way of thinking, not our way. And she came back with her two daughters-in-law, and you know how she came back with the two of them. And Naomi and Ruth were the ones who returned to the land. Now, they were childless, the two daughters-in-law, and they were Moabites. Now, it's very clear in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 3, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to their tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever. And it gives the reasons after that. So this girl was from a country which God had cursed, and from a people who God absolutely forbade to enter his sanctuary or to have anything to do with his religion. Now, let's just go on and from there and see another thing here. God overrules everything that happens to the good. Now, this book is written to show that. The higher critics say the book wasn't written then. See, the Jews held the book was written by Samuel, Now that comes from Bathsheba and the later men with Nehemiah. We don't know, but they say it wasn't written, it was written by Samuel. And the modern people say it isn't an early book, it's a very late one. And they have all sorts of arguments from words, mistrust arguments from words, because they don't work. And they're always shown to be wrong in the end. They've argued practically every book in the Old Testament because of the words, and it was late, and been shown to be wrong. So they argue that the words are late. Well, a very, very small number of words in this aren't known to be early. That doesn't mean they weren't early. And you'll find that the book was most likely written 100 years after Ruth, because if you look at the last verses, Obed begat Jesse and Jesse begat David. Either someone added those last verses, or the book was written then after David's reign. You see, it says in verse 17, he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. So it wasn't written before then, we think. But do you know why they say it was written late? Because, as usual, they're hiding, in a hypocritical fashion, their real reason. You remember in Nehemiah 13 verse 3, the Israelites were commanded to put away all their strange wives, who they had, and they'd intermarried with women from the lands around. And they had to divorce them and get rid of their children. You remember the story in Nehemiah. Well, they say this was written as a counterblast by someone at the time to give weight to the opposite side and show you didn't have to get rid of your wife because she was a Moabitess. Well, it doesn't follow, and it isn't proven by any means. So it just creates further problems. Now, let's look at this. It's got contents which are written down deliberately for us. It's written about the time of the judges. Now, that's why it's written for us. The judges was the most terrible period of Israel going into evil things and idolatry and ending up in sheer wickedness, just like today, vileness of all sorts. And the whole country, when you read Judges, makes you feel very depressed. Every time God helped them, they went straight back like a sow to her wallowing in the mire. Every time they repented, they went back, just as Peter says. The whole thing was horrible. But in the middle of the land was this little story taking place. So not everybody was bad, and it's the same today. In the middle of England walk a very different people who I meet every so often. People who are upright. People whose children have been brought up to follow the Lord. People who aren't in the whole wickedness going on around us and mourn and are sad because of it. So you see, it's a book that appeals to me because it has a little home in, like the little home we have and the little home each one of us in this church has. It's a home that's outside all this wickedness, and God knows it. And God takes these things and writes them in his book. He tells all our sighs, and he puts all our tears in his bottle. Everything is known to God from the beginning, all his works, and here it is. Now, it's called, this book, by Goethe, who is a very famous German poet, and man of considerable intellect. It's called the loveliest complete work on a small scale handed down to us as an ethical treatise and as an idyll. An idyll is just a country tale. Another German writer wrote about it. No poet in the world has written a more beautiful short story. And I think that's true. It's perhaps the most beautiful short story in the world. And I've heard many a woman say that she loves the book of Ruth. Now, its beauty lies in divine providence. You see, everything is on a small scale. All it is a village. And all it is the fields round the village. And all it is a widow woman returning to the village with her daughter-in-law. And her daughter-in-law being a foreigner, and all the difficulties they had. She was poor and the daughter-in-law was, and there's no future. And God stepped in, but not in any obvious way. He hid his hand. It's the old story that Cooper, who suffered so badly from depression, so terribly, and John Newton, this bluff old sea captain, nursed him through it. Must have been a very strange sight, because Cooper was quite an intellectual, and he came from a wealthy London family. He was offered a big job on the stock exchange, but was so nervous that he failed a very simple test, which was you had to speak for 5 minutes before being allowed into the stock exchange on a subject which you chose yourself. And he couldn't do it, he was so nervy. But you know, Cooper wrote these words when he looked back over life, how he'd had to go round between madness and sanity, how he'd lost everything, family and everything, how he's looked after by the wife of another man, really, who made friends with him. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He hides his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. He plants his footsteps, it says. But what it really means is water goes straight back to its original shape. So you can't see the footsteps once God has passed. And that's perfectly true. You can't see the footsteps of God in your life, but they're there, and they're real, and they're helpful. And their God is ordering all things. They're ordered in all things and sure, says the Bible. That's the covenant God has with you. So the beauty of this book is how it tells us about the little things of the way God is ordering life. Now, they couldn't see it. Naomi couldn't see it, Ruth couldn't see it, and Boaz couldn't see it. All these people could do was go through the muddle of life and trust God. And it's a beautiful idea. Trust God, doing justice and mercy and walking humbly with him, saying God knows best day by day. Not saying all these things are against me, but thanks be to God which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. So God knows exactly what he's about. He doesn't deal with us more hardly than we need. He never lifts a finger against us needlessly. He never smites us 1 inch more than he can help. And every blow is by love and by correction and by reproof and by instruction. He's leading us in the way everlasting. Now, this book teaches us some very good theology, and it's wonderful to look at. You'll be a better theologian than all the theologians if you understood this book fully so that it worked out in your life. Now, the first thing it does is introduces us to human nature. These two girls look very alike, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. The two parted, and you know, underneath you'll find that God is dealing with one, and the one next to them not. So that it's true there are two women grinding at one mill, and the one was taken and the other left. And there are two men working in a field, and one is taken and the other left. The thing is simply true of this life and will be in the judgment day. There's human nature is the first thing it teaches us, how complex human nature is. And so she went back to her gods, and Ruth said, I entreat thee not to leave me or to return from following thee, for whither thou goest I will go, and whither thou lodgest I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. So you see, she understood God himself. Now nobody can understand God unless God reveals himself to them. Now what it is there's a voice in this book, and it's the voice of the storyteller, the narrator, beautifully told. But the narrator has the advantage of hindsight. And with hindsight, you can see God working. It's easy to see God working backwards. It's impossible to see him working in the present or the future. And he speaks. Now he speaks, this narrator, in hints. He gives clues. And as we look carefully at the book, we learn very much about God himself. The next thing we learn, and the central point of the book, is about the Goel, the Redeemer, the one who had the power to redeem Ruth from all her troubles and to bring her to what she wanted to be, a joyful mother of children. Now this kinsman who can redeem is the Lord Jesus, and he is the subject of this book. Therefore, anybody who could preach on this book without seeing Jesus in it would have made a very great error indeed. In fact, they'd just be a Jew. Now, the fourth thing this teaches us is to, in theology, is to understand our own selves. You see, you're in this simple country tale. The story of joys, of marriage and childbirth, and of all the simple things of life that go on the same from generation to generation. It may be in an expensive hospital in London, or it may be out in Africa in a hut, but childbirth is the same. And the joys of marriage and the joys of and the difficulties of being alone and the worries and fears and torments of this life. It's all there and it's your life. Then this book teaches us something more. It teaches us another theological thing. God has a love for the whole world. Those critics are quite wrong that it was written to down Nehemiah and what God told him to do to tell the Israelites to get rid of their wives. What this book is teaching is that God has a concern for the Gentiles, even for those of the worst of the Gentiles, the Moabites. And it's a deep and real concern. The old rabbis said that Ruth was the ideal convert, because she did something very wonderful. First, she broke with her people completely. Then she added herself to God's people completely from the heart. And if you can find a woman like that, you found treasure indeed. You found something wonderful in life. Most women half leave their own country and half leave their own people and half join themselves to the Lord's people because they retain it put in both camps. But this woman dropped all her life, broke with all her past, and went straight on with God. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. You know, the Jews had real reason to regard converts and proselytes with trepidation. They behaved evilly, a lot of them. And when you read about the story of homosexuality and that, you'll find in child molestation, it took place among the Jewish proselytes, and the Jews deeply mistrusted their own proselytes for not they just brought their dirty Gentile ways into the Jewish camp, and their Jews didn't like them. Another thing is, this truly gives us a clear theological grasp of about how to follow God. You see, the way you follow God is in this order. Entreat me not to leave thee. Someone leads you to God, and you walk with that person, with all their faults. Naomi wasn't perfect. Call me Mara. For the Lord has dealt hardly with me. I went out full, and I have returned home empty. I'm bitter. Well, she can't have been that easy to be with. Bitter people aren't that easy to be with. But she had patience with the person who had led her to the Lord. And then, or to return from following after thee, she didn't want to go back. For whither thou goest, I will go. She joined herself to this woman. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. She joined herself completely. Thy people shall be my people. She started out to God by going to God's people. And I don't know, most people never find God except through God's people. And if they won't come to God's house and God's people, they'll never find God. Now they may do what they like about it, but that is the way that God has it. Thy people shall be my people is the first stage of finding God. And thy God, my God, is the second stage. So you get your relationship with God after a relationship with God's people. And that's very true. Now there's another wonderful thing of the theology of this book that it teaches us, and that is what God did in the past. So that what God did in the past was this. He did things which appear to us very strange. You remember Ruth went out to the heap of corn where Boaz was at night and asked him to put his cloak over her. That wasn't a dirty or nasty act. She was a very godly woman, Ruth. What it was this. She asked for the protection of the covenant of marriage. And that was the sign of marriage. She asked him at that moment if he would marry her. That's what she was doing when she said, "Put thy cloak over me." Now, that's a very wonderful thing. It may seem a very strange custom to us, but not as strange as the shoe. When there was another kinsman closer than Boaz, she was offered to this man first. She had to be, as he was the nearest kinsman. And he wouldn't do it. And he took a very strange custom of taking off the shoe and giving it to Boaz. And they had to spit on his face. It was a very strange old custom. But it was. Now that, the critics of course make hay while the sun shines with a custom like that. Well, they're welcome. They'll never get anywhere by all their criticism. But what it is this. God has some very strange ways about him, and that doesn't change down to this minute. And if we expect God to do what people expect him to do, he never does. I've always been surprised by God. The way he's dealt with the church in this generation of ours is to raise up red-hot Pentecostalism. Now, Pentecostalism isn't a subject I particularly love, and it isn't someone I want to be joined up to, but I have to admit that the vast majority of the world growth of the church has been in the Pentecostal camp for the last 50 years, if not 60 years. It's an immense growth has come through this Pentecostal influence. And that makes me pause about just throwing at it anything. Charismatic things are another thing I have little time for. But there is something very strange about it. You'll find these vast assemblies in South India. There are miracles going on. There are people just doing exactly like happened in the early church. And it's all Pentecostal in its ways. Now, there's a very strange thing there, but God deals in very strange ways. Now, this is to conclude. It's this. Tell people boldly that you confess Christ. When you're a new convert, whatever you do with a new convert, if ever you have one, get them to confess Christ publicly as soon as possible. And if they will not confess Christ publicly as soon as possible, they're not a real convert. That is what baptism is about. And that is why the early church baptized immediately. So they have this saying, baptized one day, preaching the next, and dead the next. Because the fact is that baptism is an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. And that was done as a testimony. And we may get people up to testify, we may get them to tell their parents, but they must. They must indeed. John Callow, who led, I think is still leading, Wycliffe in America, who was a student with me at London Bible College, an exceedingly clever fellow. He was converted. He went home that night from the meeting and told his father, and he was thrown straight out of the house onto the street. Absolutely just like that. And he wasn't allowed home anymore. He was a brilliant fellow. He had very high degrees from Oxford. Could move in languages, something like you and I can move with children's books. It was very, very strange then for Ruth. She had to confess right away what she was. Now the other thing is, you be an encourager of converts. Ruth was being entreated to leave her. Don't get converts to leave you, but do tell them the truth about the hardships they're going into. And the woman wasn't wrong to tell her that she was going into a place where she'd never get married. There were no more sons to get married to, and the whole thing was very difficult, and she was only a widow woman. Tell them the truth, but don't you ever encourage them to leave. That's what Naomi was wrong in. And then, remember that there is a Redeemer, and to introduce converts to the Redeemer who died for each one. Now, the final thing I just want to take from this book is this. Your life is in three parts, and you must think of it in three parts. At the moment, you're wandering in a strange land. We are pilgrims and sojourners on earth. We're in Moab. We've got the famine behind us, and we've got death all around us, and we've got no hope. And then there's a second part, when spiritual life starts. And that is when God begins to deal with us, and when he takes Ruth back with Naomi to her land. And it often comes after the death of the things or people we depend on. This came after the death of a husband and father-in-law and all the breadwinners in the family, and went back to a terrible situation. So that until those things are dealt with by God, we usually don't come back again. And then, when we got back, God is wonderfully leading us into the perfect situation for us on earth and in heaven. Thank you very much.